My thanks. You will each receive $200,000 for your work. It's the very least I can do. If you don't come back, your family will be taken care of. That, I assure you. Rhys looked around the room, not knowing what to say next. Sir, Chavez stood and addressed the man before him. I certainly can't speak for everyone, but please give my money to Freddie Strain's kid, the one with the special needs. Rhys swallowed hard as a chorus of voices followed suit. I'm not one for this kind of emotion, as Caroline can attest, Jonathan said, but thank you, lads. The deposit will be made. In whose name? Rhys looked around the room. From the Warrior Guardians. Chapter 67. Medny Island, Russia. Alexander descended the spiral stone staircase into what most would call a dungeon. The intelligence officer thought of it as his hypogeum, the intricate final staging area for man and beast before they were raised into the floor of the ancient Roman Colosseum to meet their fate. In this case, the cages were jail cells with two entrances and exits. One opened to the inside, the area into which Alexander now ventured, and one on the opposite side opened to a ramp leading outside into Alexander's Colosseum, Medny Island. Sergei followed close behind, carrying a large leather satchel. Most people thought of the gladiatorial games as pitting the fiercest fighters in Rome against one another in barbaric battles for the joy of the crowd, but Alexander preferred the Venetian. It was a spectacle in which the beasts of the Republic were set loose against Venators, the most respected hunters in Rome. Though Alexander hunted humans, he thought of them as game. They were his dentati. The level had room for 8 single cells. 6 held the Africans from the Central African Republic who had arrived on the latest flight. Criminals from the mines who would be executed in Africa or hunted in Russia. Better they have a fighting chance against Alexander and his clients than die on their knees as slaves in the red dirt of their homeland. Alexander and Sergei passed the 7th cage, now empty after its occupant had given Alexander a good warm-up 2 days prior. He was ready. His skills were sharp. He was hungry. They stopped at the last cave, and Alexander came face to face with the adversary he'd been seeking.
S. Rainsford, a clever pen name. I am Alexander Zharkov.
Rafe remained silent, studying his foe with an intensity that sent a chill down Alexander's spine.
A worthy opponent.
My sister, Rafe said.
Your sister is dead. But just like the deer that comes to the feeder, or the leopard who climbs the tree after rotting zebra meat placed there by those who hunt him, you are here.
You are a sick fuck, Rafe spat.
Oh, come now, S. Rainsford. Your writing on our sport is so eloquent. Do not stoop to such a level. Leave that to the Africans. Tomorrow we hunt, or I should say, I hunt. You will be fed well tonight, and just before dawn, the cell doors behind you will open. A ramp will lead you up to ground level, where another door will be open. Sergei will have you in the sights of my very capable Dragunov. It's the only time he uses a modern weapon, and rest assured, he will not miss if you force him to take a shot. Some have chosen this option, but I know that you will not. You want to kill me. I had to ensure you would come and that you would play. It's a pity that your friend James Rhys isn't here with you. How I would have loved to hunt you both. If I don't kill you tomorrow, he'll finish the job. Unfortunately for us both, that will not be the case. Your friend Rhys is on his way here now with a makeshift band of misfits. In all likelihood, they will be slaughtered by my security forces as they make landfall. You look surprised, S. Rainsford. Do you think our intelligence apparatus died at the end of the Cold War? I can assure you, it is still very much in place, stronger now than it ever was. And if I don't play? Ah, you will play, S. Rainsford. You will play, because that is your only chance to kill me. I hunted your sister out of this very cage,
Alexander said, looking around as if recounting a fond memory.
Don't worry. She was treated well. She was not violated. I needed her in top condition. She was strong, that one. Strong and smart.
Rafe and Alexander's attention was drawn to a scraping sound as Sergei pushed a table across the cold cement floor, positioning it in front of Rafe's cage.
I want you motivated tomorrow, S. Rainsford. I know you will be, but just in case, this should help.
Sergei handed his master the leather satchel, which Alexander placed on the table, unclasping the two brass buckles that held it closed. With great respect and ceremony, Alexander reached inside and pulled out a large glass container. Looking admiringly at its contents, he placed it on the table in front of Rafe's cell.
Good luck tomorrow, Rainsford, he said, before walking to the stairs that led to the main level.
Already thinking of the thick moose steaks Sergei would grill for their supper. He left Rafe alone in his cell, staring into the lifeless, upturned eyes of his dead sister. Chapter 68. Glacier Park International Airport, Kalispell, Montana. A Gulfstream G550, also known as a G5SP, is one of the most versatile and luxurious business jets that money can buy. With a $45 million price tag, it was built for comfort and speed over extended distances. Despite its spacious interior, which can accommodate up to 19 passengers, it was not designed to accommodate 5 hey-ho jumpers, a dog, and all the weapons and gear necessary to perform a clandestine night insertion into a foreign nation via parachute. The aircraft's interior was divided into 3 main sections: a forward club section with 4 leather seats facing one another over a small table, a 4-place divan configured sideways with 2 seats across the aisle, and an aft sleeping compartment. This arrangement allowed every member of the rescue team a seat, leaving their gear distributed around the cabin and in the aft baggage area. For operators accustomed to making transcontinental flights on the nylon-strapped seats of military transport aircraft, it was a crowded but welcome change. The team inspected, checked, and double-checked their gear before loading it onto the plane. As Jumpmaster Farkas carefully inspected each parachute rig before they were loaded, since conditions before the jump would not be as ideal for doing so. If one didn't know any better, it looked like a professional soccer or rugby team was boarding the aircraft for an away match. Farkas, can you rig this up for me? Rhys asked, extending the Eccles legend his father had given him.
I knew you were going to grab a sniper rifle, Farkas smiled. Yeah, I'll rig it up.
Just in case, Rhys said.
Just in case, Farkas acknowledged.
In the absence of a flight attendant, Liz performed the FAA-mandated safety briefing and indicated the location of the emergency exits. The forward cabin door is the primary means of exiting the aircraft, but additional exits over the wing can be accessed in an emergency, she said, doing her best flight attendant hand sweep toward the window exits. In the event of a high-altitude jump over a hostile nation, the aft baggage door is the preferred method of egress, she said, evoking a laugh from the team. The plane accelerated down the runway and surged skyward thanks to its powerful Rolls-Royce engines. Within minutes, they were at their cruising altitude of 40,000 feet,
moving at a steady speed of Mach 0.83. What always surprised Reese was how quiet this aircraft was, its engineers obviously spending far more time and effort on passenger comfort than those who designed airliners. As soon as the plane took off, every operator went into their own world, listening to music, reading, or sleeping. Eli went into the crew rest compartment and began laying out medical gear in case the Gulfstream became an air ambulance. IV drips were prepared, bandages arranged, and various medications were lined up on the nightstand. Satisfied that things were as ready for an emergency as they could be, he returned to his seat and opened a Russian language app on his iPhone. Reese couldn't sleep. He spent his time deep in thought, going over the jump, the contingencies at every phase of the operation. With no backup, there were only two words to describe what they were about to attempt: suicide mission. Those who were sleeping were jolted awake as the plane touched down in Anchorage and slowed to turn off runway 7 right. The operators peered out the windows at the unique array of aircraft. Everything from balloon-tired Super Cubs to various float planes were visible in what seemed like every direction. Due to Alaska's size and the remote location of many of its cities, towns, and wilderness areas, it has the highest per capita rate of aircraft ownership in the nation. The Gulfstream taxied to Signature Flight Support, one of the field's fixed-base operators, where the engines were shut down. The window shades were lowered, and Liz opened the cabin door to coordinate refueling. All five of the rescuers stayed on board and out of sight, no sense arousing any suspicions about the nature of their journey or cargo. The cold air blowing through the open door was a warning of the temperatures they'd be facing when they eventually exited the aircraft. Eli made a comment under his breath about these being sub-Hawaiian temperatures as he pulled a stocking cap over his head. Once the plane was fueled, the pilots used an iPad application called ForeFlight to file their flight plan electronically. According to that plan, they would travel from Anchorage to Haneda Airport in Tokyo, Japan, via Bethel, Alaska, and onto Route R220, which passed almost directly over the Commander Islands, though they had no intentions of following that route all the way to Tokyo. They also filed an E-APIS report with the Department of Homeland Security, a requirement when filing an international flight plan. Only the pilots' names were listed on the report, since the five commandos in the back would not be aboard when the plane made its next stop. Since they had so recently landed, the pilots performed a rotor bow, motoring the engines for 30 seconds to thermally stabilize them before the start sequence was initialized. All systems read normal as the engines idled and the takeoff procedures began. They were wheels up within the hour, and once airborne, Liz announced they were 3 hours and 26 minutes out from the drop. Reese leaned back in his seat. Next stop, Russia. Chapter 69. As they flew over the Alaskan Peninsula, Reese warmed up dinner, piping hot bowls of venison chili and freshly baked cornbread, all prepared by Caroline Hastings in advance of their departure. They devoured what they knew could be their last meal. Reese pressed his head against the window and looked down at the lights of sparsely populated villages. He wondered how many Americans remembered that the only land battle of World War II fought on American soil took place on the barren volcanic islands 30,000 feet below. The Battle of Attu was all but forgotten these days. 549 U.S. troops lost their lives defending home soil from Japanese invaders in May 1945. 1,148 were wounded, and 1,814 were taken out of the fight for cold injuries and disease. The battle marked one of the largest banzai charges of the war. Of the 2,379 Japanese troops that began the battle, only 28 survived to be captured. The battle also drove the military to improve cold weather warfare gear, innovations that continued to evolve into what Reese and his men would use on Medney Island. One by one, they hit the lavatory and began dressing for the mission. When exiting an aircraft at this altitude, temperatures could be minus 50 centigrade. Without protection from the cold, they would freeze to death in minutes. These extreme temperatures required them to wear several layers of synthetic clothing specially designed for Arctic warfare. The clothing system, known as the Protective Combat Uniform, PCU, was developed by the Army's Natick Soldier Systems Center with input from alpine climbing legend and Jim Jones founder Mark Twite and manufactured by Patagonia. White and gray splotched multi-cam alpine combat overwhites completed the ensemble, topped off with body armor before donning specially designed Hayho gray synthetic thermal suits that would be discarded once they hit the ground. Farkas received a weather update from the cockpit that he used to make his final navigational calculations. The Gulf Stream was indicating winds from 250 degrees at 40 miles per hour, which matched the earlier forecast and gave him confidence that the report was accurate. They would be at the absolute limits in terms of their gliding distance to the target. If the winds shifted, or worse, reversed, they would find themselves in the icy Bering Sea, dead within minutes. Farkas reinspected each man's gear, physically running his hands across every strap, every buckle, every seam. There would be no second chances. Route R220 ran parallel to Russia's Air Defense Identification Zone, or ADIZ. It was important to stick to established commercial airline routes when making a covert insertion into denied territory. If they deviated too far from the official route, Russian radar operators monitoring the Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky airspace would take note of their location and alert interceptor aircraft based in Magadan. A MiG-31 could shoot down the Gulf Stream from 200 miles away. To avoid that disaster, the pilots only allowed their course to divert slightly from the center of the route, putting them at the absolute edge of the ADIZ, 48.5 miles from the tip of Medny Island. Devon let Ado walk among the operators, sniffing and saying hello. The dog handler wanted Ado to know the difference between friend and foe if he was given the command to bite. Using the buddy system, the band of mercenaries donned parachutes with ATAC, or Android Tactical Assault Kits, in a chest-mounted Juggernaut navigation board MFF T2, with backup Garmin Fortrex GPS and Oceanic Compass, in case the primary system failed. The ATAC was a military-specific smartphone app that provided users with real-time geospatial situational awareness, communication, navigation, and targeting information. Their weapons had been fitted with tape to hold down anything they didn't want flying off in the violence of exiting an aircraft moving at 500 miles per hour. The muzzle, ejector port, handguard, optics, laser, and magazine all had riggers tape adhering them to the rifles, which were mounted horizontally across their waists. Reese had the added benefit of having the Eccles Legend strapped vertically to his right side in a padded case with foam taped around the scope, just in case. Weapons were strapped to jump harnesses, and with a final check of nods, helmets were secured in place, oxygen masks dangling to the sides. The G550 was flying at 35,000 feet, but the cabin was pressurized for 8,000. An hour out from the drop, the cabin pressure was adjusted to 10,000 feet. The commandos took their seats and plugged into a supplemental O2 unit on the floor of the aircraft. Resembling a large pelican case with dials and knobs that looked foreign to Reese, it allowed the jumpers to breathe 100% oxygen without depleting the small green tanks strapped to their chests. Ado had a nasal cannula rigged inside his muzzle. Reese always wondered how much O2 the dogs were actually getting. Decompression sickness, otherwise known as the bends, is an ailment usually associated with scuba diving, but the risks of such a physiological event are equally as great during high-altitude parachute jumps. Residual nitrogen in the bloodstream can, upon descent, turn into bubbles that can migrate throughout the body and cause pain, paralysis, and death. To prevent the onset of decompression sickness, they pre-breathed for an hour. Any nitrogen remaining in their bodies, even any ingested while switching oxygen tanks, could be deadly.